you wouldn't, I don't think, try to use a lawnmower to vacuum your living room carpet. Neither would you try to use a vacuum cleaner to mow your backyard. Unless, that is, you work at my local pub with its artificial turf outside. Every morning someone has to come out and give that grass a quick once-over with a Henry Hoover. But you'll never see anything like that happening on Wimbledon Centre Court. You wouldn't, I don't think, try to dry your laundry in a microwave. Neither would you attempt to wash your clothes in a dishwasher. If you did, all your efforts would be based on a lack of knowledge, a failure to understand what those appliances were for. Although we might like to applaud your resourcefulness and resolve, as you plow on, hoping for a good outcome, at some point, someone needs to do the caring thing. Someone needs to take you aside for that hard conversation. This that you're using towards that end, you're using it in the false hope that it will give you something that it was never designed to deliver. That it will give you something that it was never designed to deliver. Zeal without knowledge is a wasted thing. Here in Romans chapter 10, we see the Apostle Paul's heart going out to his fellow countrymen, the Israelites. And this is their story, verse 3. Since they did not know the righteousness of God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Righteousness, being in the right with God. Paul here speaks of two contrasting sources of righteousness. The one, a righteousness that comes from God. The other, a righteousness that comes from ourselves. Let's compare these two. The righteousness that comes from God is a declaration. It is God saying, you are in the right with me. It is his gracious favor towards us. The righteousness that comes from ourselves is a claim. It is me saying to God, I am in the right with you. It carries with it the expectation of earned favor. The latter leads to arrogant pride. The former leads to humble submission. And to look at these two together, what we're seeing is two opposing systems of salvation. Now, a person seeking to establish a righteousness of their own can go about it any number of ways. Every time that person thinks or says or does anything on the basis of which they hope to put themselves in God's good book, they're doing exactly this. For the Israelites of Paul's day, they were seeking to establish a righteousness of their own in one particular way, through certain obedience to God's law, the law given to them through Moses. Now, by contrast, a person submitting to God's righteousness always goes about it one way. That is, by faith. They simply believe on those promises of God which meet us in the person of Jesus Christ. So what, you ask? Well, here's the thing. A righteousness which comes to us from God through faith, and a righteousness that comes from ourselves, whether through the law or by any other means. The question is, are they both legitimate? Will they both put us in the right with God? Paul here takes issue with that so-called righteousness that comes by the law. It's time for the hard conversation with his fellow countrymen and any others who may be sold out down that road. The law that you're using in the pursuit of righteousness, you're using it in the false hope that it will give you something that it was never designed to deliver. Something that it was never designed to deliver. Zeal without knowledge is at best a wasted thing. Zeal without knowledge so easily becomes a very dangerous thing. Paul knew all this from personal experience. In his letter to the Philippians, he recounts how, in the pursuit of a righteousness of his own based on the law, he had been faultless. But then Paul's life had been revolutionized by Jesus Christ, and suddenly he could see that in comparison to the righteousness that comes from God, that righteousness of his own making was little more than a pile of rubbish. So Paul's heart truly goes out to the Israelites. He too had been standing exactly where many of them were still standing, on a road that they may have hoped was taking them in one direction, but was in fact taking them in quite another. Jesus Christ is the touchstone in all this. For the person who has submitted to the righteousness of God, Jesus himself has become their righteousness. He himself puts them in the right with God. He is very much the foundation stone on which the whole of their life and hopes are built. They have a sure footing. But the person pursuing a righteousness of their own, for them, this same Jesus is an inconvenience, an obstacle, even an offense. Jesus undermines and frustrates that person's efforts at every turn. He is to them, glancing up at chapter 9, verse 32, a stumbling stone. Their feet continue to trip. Why? See verse 4. Christ is the culmination of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. Jesus Christ brings to an end all of our self-salvation projects. To every person following whatever regime or self-improvement plan, in the hope of putting themselves in the right with God, to them, Jesus says a decisive no. He says that because their zeal isn't based on knowledge. If it were, then they would recognize that Jesus himself has already achieved all that is necessary for all who call on him to be declared righteous. If it were, well, then they would already have fallen down at Jesus' feet in worship. The truth is, we don't change easily. Verse 5, Moses writes this about the righteousness that is by the law. The person who does these things will live by them. The person who does these things will live by them. Now, it's not that in doing the things the law requires, you will get the life you're hoping for. Rather, the continual doing of the things you think the law requires, in the belief that that will deliver you the good life, even though it won't, that is what most characterizes your living. Have you ever tried walking up a down escalator? Can be quite fun, if you're daring enough and no one else is around. But something would have gone very wrong if every time you saw a down escalator, you tried to walk up it. Because then somehow you've come to expect from it something it isn't designed to deliver. If you keep on keeping on, even when people are yelling at you to the contrary, well, that's when you've crossed the line from uninformed zeal to pure obstinacy. Seeking after a righteousness that is by the law is very much like attempting to ascend a down escalator. Glance back at verse 4. Christ is the culmination of the law. Culmination, summation, end point, goal. All these ideas are wrapped up in what Paul is saying here. Moses, all those centuries before, in a sense, he finished giving the law to the Israelites by preaching to them. What better way of ensuring they went away with a right understanding? He preached to them. And that preaching became the book of Deuteronomy. What does Moses make the culmination, the climax, the summation of the law? Having loaded them down with a heavy burden, does he now give them an encouraging pat on the back with the words, "Keep on climbing"? No. This is how Moses draws things to a head in Deuteronomy chapter 30. What I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven so that you have to ask, "Who will ascend into heaven to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it?" Nor is it beyond the sea, so that you have to ask, "Who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it?" No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so that you may obey it. The culmination of the law is a word that has come very near into our hearts and mouths. That word, that message, runs like this. Righteousness doesn't come from our resourcefulness, from our making the steady upward ascent into heaven. Instead, righteousness comes to us from the one who has made the downward descent from heaven on our behalf. Here in Romans 10, Paul makes common cause with Moses. He isn't calling his fellow Israelites to something new. He is simply recalling them to their truest roots. Righteousness has always been by faith. Salvation has always been the Lord at work on their behalf. Verse 6, who will ascend into heaven? That is, to bring Christ down. Or who will descend into the deep? That is, to bring Christ up from the dead. Jesus Christ has descended from heaven to earth to live the way we should have lived. Furthermore, Jesus Christ has descended into the deep, into death itself, in punishment for the ways we should not have lived. What does that mean? Freedom from the obligations of the law and the call to live a righteous life? No. But what this does mean is freedom from a wrong thinking about the law, from seeing it as a system of salvation by which we might get right with God. Salvation comes to every person and any person who can declare for themselves, "Jesus is Lord." Verse 9. That's no mere form of words. There's a whole world of belief encapsulated in such a simple creed. To cry Jesus is Lord is to recognize him as the one who comes from heaven itself, God in the flesh. To cry Jesus is Lord is to recognize him as the one with authority over every power, triumphant from the grave. And his reach? No one is outside his reach. Jesus reaches down into the very deepest depths to save. Hear that message. The promise is everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. For you to cry, Jesus is Lord, that's to declare him your Lord, to own him as your salvation. Our mouths, they always speak from the overflow of our hearts. When our hearts have been impacted by these truths, we can do no other than make this cry. Now, if only all this had become true for the nation of Israel, as it had for Paul himself. But it didn't. And so Paul's heart goes out to them. Certainly, many Israelites did come to believe from that moment that the good news began to be proclaimed in Jerusalem on into the apostles' own preaching ministry. But naturally, Paul's heart goes out to those who didn't respond. And that prompts this question. Why didn't they believe? Why didn't they believe? We may have our answer if we first ask two other questions. Did they not hear? And did they not understand? First, did they not hear? Verse 18. The message that Jesus is Lord has rung out into all the earth, to the ends of the world. It knows no bounds. If that is so, then there could be no Israelite living anywhere who found themselves out of earshot. Did they hear? The answer is, of course they did. Yet, hearing doesn't always lead to understanding. So we should ask, secondly, did they not understand? Verse 19. Paul returns us to the book of Deuteronomy, where he draws on an example of how Gentile nations, those steeped in idolatry and unbelief with no understanding, how it is that they have often come to understand. Israel had the privileges of the teachings of Moses and all the prophets. At certain times in their history, their national life was set up in such a way as to be a powerful visual aid, speaking to the people of every good promise the Lord had made. What resources they had at their disposal to correct any misunderstanding. By comparison, all the Gentile nations were positively on the back foot, at a severe disadvantage. All they gleaned was from a distance. Yet if they could come to understand, Israel should rightly be envious. It's not as though God were the passive one, sat back waiting for the Israelites to take the initiative. No, it was quite the reverse. As the Lord himself says in verse 20, I was found by those who did not seek me. I revealed myself to those who did not ask for me. It is always that way. The Lord first pursues. The Lord first reveals. The Lord first knocks on the door of our lives, wherever his word is proclaimed. So where does all this leave the Israelites? it leaves them without excuse. There can be no excuse for their unbelief. Why then didn't they believe? Our first question still stands. One of the joys of having young children is engaging with them when they've become so convinced that something is the case when it isn't. Like when they start saying a pigeon is actually a duck, or that a story is actually different to how it's written in the book. Their zeal is quite endearing. But their zeal isn't based on knowledge. Occasionally, a young child becomes so intent on defending their corner that their zeal turns to obstinacy, and they will let nothing move them from their chosen position. Of course, that all changes when we grow up. Or does it? Friends, why didn't the Israelites come to believe? Why, instead of submitting to God's righteousness and the joy of his salvation, why did they continue on in their vain pursuit of a righteousness of their own? All in all, it had little to do with their location in time or place, their advantages or disadvantages. That which most kept the Israelites from believing is that very thing that unites them with all people in every time and place, ourselves included. See verse 21. They were a disobedient and obstinate people. It is possible to be so set in our ways, always treading the down escalator, such that we will let nothing and no one move us. Even though Jesus Christ should hold out his hands to us with the offer of life, we resolve to keep treading our own path, even down into death. We all know people like that. We all know that we are people like that. May it not be the defining thing about any of us here this morning that our hearts are beset with prideful obstinacy. Rather, may it be true that this word that has come near us would take deep root in those same hearts this morning, bringing about that humble submission which leads us all to declare, Jesus is Lord. Amen.